Everybody, as always, thank you to Nia Simone. This is Eric Mann. I'm the host of Voices from the Frontlines. You're on KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live on, as Ed Asner said, the World Wide Web at kpfk.org. I think we have a very exciting show today, and I just want to add one thing before we go to talk to Edwards, is that next week is the Fun Drive, and the beginning of another fun drive, and Voices from the Frontlines really wants to play a more active role in making these fun drives both programmatically more interesting, but also getting you all to spend more money and actually support the station and our show. So I'm giving you a heads up. For the last month, I've been down in Mississippi, in Jackson, Mississippi, with a terrific team, Julian, Catherine, and William, and we've been down in Mississippi. We've done 11 different interviews with leaders of the civil rights movement 50 years later. We're making it up to a 4-CD set. A lot of you have heard it before, and you've heard segments of it, but we're going to have it ready for next Tuesday's Fun Drive. And we're going to be able to play some wonderful clips of Julian Bond, Danny Glover, Frankie Adams Johnson, Derek Johnson of the NAACP in Mississippi. And we'll be doing these 5-minute clips followed by some conversation. So we're going to have a lot of program on next Tuesday. But the model is, can you give some money? Because I don't want to keep going 818-985-5735. And neither do you. So get ready now to give money next Tuesday. And we're going to hear Dr. Harry Edwards. So welcome back to Voices from the Frontlines. Again, this is your host, Eric Mann. And we're talking now to Professor and Dr. Harry Edwards, longtime leader in the civil rights movement, from my perspective. How you doing, Dr. Edwards?
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, let me start with the conversation you and I were having a little bit yesterday about trying to unravel the class contradictions in the whole sports world. I just want to tell you, you know, the main conversation is not going to be about my article, but I just want to tell you some openings that I've been thinking about and wanted your opinions on. As you know, we've been organizing in Los Angeles in the Black and Latino communities for 25 years. In the Black and Latino communities, primarily among bus riders, high school students, the very lowest income people, against the police, against transit racism. It's not a secret that we have a theory called the Black United Front, the Multiracial United Front, and we still believe in that theory. But it's been very, very difficult over the last 25 years to get the Black and Latino middle and upper and business classes to side with the working classes and lower income classes. And increasingly, some of them have become actively participating in what we call the privatizing, polluting, policing urban plan, getting contracts to do Staples Center or owning Staples Center. You know, Magic Johnson owns a great deal of Los Angeles and wants to own more. Michael Jordan now owns the Charlotte Hornets, and he's become a billionaire. So how do you deal with the fact that on one hand, Donald Sterling attacks Magic Johnson, and we in the movement strongly oppose what Donald Sterling says? We jump out, we criticize him. But then the next week, when 500,000 bus riders are fighting a fare increase against transit racism, we can't get the support of Magic Johnson. I know you've been working this angle your whole life. How are you seeing it today?
Well, first of all, I think we have to understand the evolution of this whole situation. The struggle in sports goes back to actually the turn of the 20th century, when you began to get these gentlemen's agreements from baseball to horse racing that would exclude African Americans, and that left African American athletes in a struggle for really legitimacy, and they got their greatest inroads not in side of this country, but actually externally in the international sports arena. So you had Jack Johnson, you had the heavyweight boxing champion of the world, you had Joe Louis, the heavyweight boxing champion of the world, Jesse Owens with regard to the Olympic Games. That whole struggle was about legitimacy. Internally, you had basically a parallel sports institution with African Americans in basketball, the Chicago Bears, the DC Bears. I'm sorry, the New York Renaissance team. You had most certainly the Negro Leagues, two or three different sets of Negro Leagues, who generated great baseball players. And then post World War II, you had the desegregation efforts that went forward, not so much out of brotherhood as of business considerations. Branch Rickey understood that baseball, coming out of World War II with a severe recession and severe manpower shortage, had to create a new business model, and that's what he did by reaching into the player pool of the Negro Leagues, as well as reaching out to the black dollars that were out there to support baseball. And he knew that blacks would come to watch blacks play in Major League Baseball, literally to the demise of the Negro Leagues and all of those parallel structures. The same thing happened with basketball. The same thing happened with football when Kenny Washington and Woody Strode from UCLA went into the Los Angeles Rams. When Bill Willis and Marion Motley went into the Cleveland Browns, you began to have a movement away from historic black leagues and so forth. With that came the demise of those leagues, and of course that parallels what was happening in African-American society as desegregation there proceeded one way, an individual, as opposed to what many black people wanted, which was two-way and institutional. They didn't go in and bring the entire New York elite Giants black baseball team in the Major League Baseball. They went in and cherry-picked the athletes. The same thing happened in African-American society. You had people who were on or within the view of the mobility ladder moving out of the African-American community, leaving behind institutions that became more and more destitute and dysfunctional, leaving behind the people who were dependent upon those institutions to find their own way without the kinds of institutional support and so forth that they had traditionally had as members of the black community. So we began to evolve toward separate peoples in a very real sense. You had those who moved into and onto the periphery of white society and white institutions, and you had those who were left behind to really fend for themselves. And of course, ultimately, they became more and more involved in the underground and underworld communities. When you began to talk about working class, for a substantial portion of the African American community, that label does not apply because they have no involvement whatsoever with the mainstream economic structure. They become involved in the underworld and underground economy, which puts them in the judicial system and a prison industrial complex, which means they become not only unemployed, but more and more unemployable. The situation has evolved today where we have virtually evolved into two separate peoples with different worldviews, different sets of political interests, different perspectives, and a different way of organizing and moving forward. The one ubiquitous, unchanging reality is that the fate of those who migrated out, the so-called middle and upper classes of black society, the fate and fortunes of those people are inextricably bound with the fate and fortunes of those who were left behind. That is the contradiction that we must manage to resolve. How do we speak for the interest of both groups? Because Magic, for all of his money and all of his wealth, Michael Jordan, for all of his money and all of his wealth, their status is not changed in the eyes of the Don Sterlings of the society. And anyone who thinks that Don Sterling stands alone in those perspectives, either inside or outside of sports, is irrational.
Well, let me ask you this, Harry. Let me respond to this. I think one of the questions that's always been a complicated story is that obviously during the 60s, the fight for integration, the fight of all the classes, obviously, in the black community against Jim Crow, right, against segregation, created again this concept of a united front. You're clearly right in saying that the splits are getting greater. So here's a problem I'm trying to ask your opinion on, is that one of the dilemmas is that if, in fact, obviously, when President Obama runs for office, and I did enthusiastically support him in 2008 and more strategically in 2012 against Mitt Romney, you see that every single member of the black community is thrilled. If people attack President Obama, virtually every black person wants to rally to his side. But when President Obama attacks the black masses, they don't fight. They just don't. And that's been one of the problems. The high school kids will, you know, but all the other structures will unite around the president. So here's the dilemma. If Donald Sterling attacks Magic Johnson, black working people are going to defend Magic Johnson correctly. If LeBron James is told that he's a prodigal son, a sinner who returns back to Cleveland, I'm going to write an article saying he's not a prodigal son. He had every right to leave. He had every right to come back. He's not a traitor. You saw what Kareem wrote about him. He's a philandering. I mean, crazy stuff. So I write an article to defend LeBron. But then I point out that Dan Gilbert, the chairman and founder of Rock Ventures and Quicken Loans, is the owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers. And I go into a whole description of all the corporate backing of, as you point out, of the white capitalist class. So as an organizer, how do we address the fact, do you think we should rally when a Magic is attacked or when an Obama is attacked or when a LeBron James, men who do have power? I think we have to. But then the question is, how do we also educate people to fight for their own class interest inside the United Front?
Well, you know, look, the fate of LeBron James and Magic Johnson and Michael Jordan and Barack Obama, their fate and fortunes are inextricably bound up with those of the black masses. They are not going anywhere, really, that the black masses don't go. A lot of what's happening in terms of the presidency and the opposition that he faces and so forth is not because of his policies. He can't pass policies that the Republicans came up with.
That's right.
It's because he's black, and anybody who says anything else is either naive or outright lying. The reality is that a lot of the opposition to President Barack Obama comes as a consequence of him being black. Donald Sterling's opposition to Magic Johnson being seen with his paramour wasn't because Magic lost the game or because the Lakers beat the Clippers. It was because he was black. And so that's the same treatment that the brothers get walking down the street. There's a lot of discussion about the fact that all of the people who are gay who have come out have been black. Whether you're talking about Michael Sam, whether you're talking about...
That's very interesting. That's right.
Yeah, they've all been black because the gay is a second-tier issue with them. They're not going to be stopped walking down the street because they're gay. They're not going to be trailed in a department store because they're gay. They're not going to have their head cracked by a police officer because they're gay. The principal problem is going to be the contradiction of being black in a society that has substantial countercurrents of race and racism. So must we defend them? We're not just defending Barack Obama or defending Magic Johnson. We're defending our rights and the rights of black people to be free citizens in this country. When LeBron James was attacked for leaving Cleveland, he wasn't attacked as a basketball player. He was attacked as a black man who insisted on exercising his own market prerogatives. You don't do that. If you are Peyton Manning, you can come out and say, I'm not going to that team, I want to go to this team. If you are an Eli Manning, you can come out and say, I'm not
That's
going
right.
to
I don't want to go to San Diego.
I'm going to New York. And everybody applauds. Geez, what a great decision. You know, the young man has some ideas and so forth, and he's from a smart family. His father is really managing him well. But if you're black and do that, simply want to hold out for a better contract, you become, because you, if you're black, or do not have the latitude to exercise that kind of decision-making power and authority, even over your own life and career. So, yeah, we have to defend these people, not as basketball players, not as wealthy African-Americans, but as African-Americans, because they're all in the same boat that we're in. Whether or not they realize it on a day-to-day basis and do things that oftentimes they think is in their business interest as opposed to their mass political interest, that's another question. How do we meld those two things together? I think, unfortunately, it comes down oftentimes to the what I call the O.J. Simpson complex. That is to say, O.J. was everything but black up until They tried to hang these two murders on him, and then all of a sudden, he became, hey, one of the blackest people that you could imagine. The whole thing was about a race issue as far as he was concerned. And unfortunately, in many instances, it takes that kind of pressure on them to identify, but I think that more and more they're coming around to understand that they're not going anywhere that the black masses don't go. It's as simple as that.
Well, Harry, that's great. I want to read you just one paragraph that I think supports and agrees with your point of view, and then I want to move, if it's okay, to the 68 Olympics. It's supporting what you just said. In my article, it says, from slavery to Jim Crow and the black codes to the present mass incarceration of black and Latino people, what Michelle Alexander has called the new Jim Crow, the role of white society is to restrain, constrain, punish, and mutilate the black body and soul, to make every day of life unbearable, and to support super exploitation through Klan and police terror, what we in the civil rights movement used to call blue by day and white by night. In particular, the system has always made clear that black folks do not have the right to come and go as they please. They're subjected to an occupying army of police as Latino immigrants are hunted down by ICE. The system constructs a series of legal constraints in which especially black youth, who they fear as potential rebels and revolutionaries, are arrested for loitering, truancy, disrespecting an officer, jaywalking, that make it illegal for black folks to do, say, walk, ride, or be anything and anywhere the white man prohibits. So that was my effort to learn from your politics and hopefully advance a common perspective.
I think you're absolutely correct in that perspective. I think that let me say this. I won't say white people because there are white people who I love dearly.
And I didn't say white people either. I said white society.
Absolutely. So I'm not going to paint that broad brush stroke. You know, I think that there are white people out there who would load a black man's gun in defense of broadening the basis of democratic participation by all peoples in American society. But I will say this, that for mainstream white institutions, white-dominated institutions, there really has not been a comfortable place with black presence since slavery. There's always a question of somebody getting too big, too powerful, too independent, too out of control. I don't care if you're talking about the President of the United States. And if it occurs all the way up to that level institutionally, then the 15-year-old kid on the street who's walking along with a package of Skittles and an iced tea, a can of iced tea, is eminently vulnerable. So, again, I don't think institutionally in American society there has been a place of absolute comfort in the presence of blacks since slavery. We're still looking for that place. And it doesn't make any difference if it's the President of the United States, if it's Magic Johnson, if it's Michael Jordan. I don't care who it is or how accommodating and happy-go-lucky they are, there is a discomfort zone.
That's right.
That occurs in mainstream institutions with a black presence, much less a black power and authority in terms of the ability to move and go and come as they see fit.
Well, Harry, in your last couple of thoughts, I mean, you're very influential. I just finished Peniel Joseph's book on Stokely. We talk to our readers a lot. We read from Black Reconstruction America by W.E.B. Du Bois and talk about the 12 years of black possible majority rule and the ferocious way that the North literally sacrificed all the black soldiers who left the plantation, helped the North win, and then threw them back into the arms of the Klan. So I think you and I come from a similar tradition. I've been very influenced by you. In the last 5 minutes, and we'll have you back on the show in more time, tell a lot of the young listeners about what does Tommy Smith and John Carlos mean to them today?
Yes. You have to understand the context within which the Olympic Project for Human Rights was organized. Everybody talks about the I Have a Dream speech in 1963. But what they don't talk about was that in 1963, Mega Evers was murdered.
That's
right. It was
right.
40 years before his murderer was even brought to trial. 2 weeks after the I Have a Dream speech and the March on Washington, a church was bombed in Birmingham where four little girls going to church were murdered. In that same year, you had three civil rights workers who were murdered, lynched, because they were trying to organize blacks to vote, get blacks registered to vote. You had Dr. Martin Luther King, who was shot down in 1968. You had people like Ralph Featherstone, a regional director of SNCC, who was blown up with a bomb in his car as he was traveling through the South. You had, of course, people who were lynched and killed whose deaths were not as widely publicized. So our basic perspective in 1968 was, why should we go over to the Olympic Games and represent a country that where this was happening, and the government apparently was either powerless or unwilling to stop it, unwilling to even bring those who had committed these atrocities against us to justice. But we were supposed to go over and run in the Olympic Games. And of course, the ubiquitous picture of black and white together, wrapped in the flag, taking a victory lap before the entire world, this was the image that we were unwilling to portray in the face of these atrocities, in the face of these terrorist attacks on us for simply trying to broaden the basis of our democratic participation in the society. We felt that athletes in the greatest political form outside of the United Nations itself, and the Olympics were political. I mean, you could go back to the 1904 racial Olympics to show that. You could go to the 36 Olympics to show that. You could look at the medal counting between the United States and the Soviet Union see that the games were political. So the games were political. We weren't interjecting politics into the games. We weren't even airing America's dirty laundry at the games. America's dirty laundry was aired when the assassination of Dr. King was on the front page of every paper in the country, when four little girls were blown up while praying in church was on the front page of every newspaper in every country in the world, when Meg Evers' assassination was in the newspapers of the world. That is when America's dirty laundry was aired. We were airing America's good side, that we had the right to protest far right, especially at the Olympic Games as athletes. That was part of our obligation. That was part of our mandate as heirs to Jackie Robinson, who first introduced us to nonviolent direct action as a method of achieving a broadening of the basis of democratic participation in American society. So we have no apologies whatsoever for the demonstrations in Mexico City, and I have to take my good friend Bill Russell's perspective on it. When a reporter walked up to Bill Russell after the demonstrations in Mexico City and said, "Bill, you were an Olympian in 1956, a gold medal winner, a great athlete, you're Sportsman of the Year this year in terms of your professional NBA championship. Do you have any problem with what happened with the Olympic Project for Human Rights and Tommy Smith and John Carlos demonstrating at the podium of in Mexico City as the Star Spangled Banner was played and the flag was raised?" And Bill Russell thought for a minute, then he said, "Yeah." He said, "I have a serious problem with it." And the reporter got his, you know, we're getting ready to write this down. Right. So he said, "Yeah, I have a problem with it. I didn't think of it first." So at the end of it, we offer no apologies for what our generation did, just as we are certain that this generation, too, will find its stride in terms of the politics of sport. The thing we have to understand, whether we're looking in the arena or beyond the arena, this thing of race and racialism is so deeply embedded in American culture that we have to understand that our circumstances are dynamic and diverse. Therefore, our struggle must be multifaceted, including sport, and perpetual. And there are no final victories. Jackie Robinson wasn't a final victory. Smith and Carlos is not a final victory. LeBron James getting up and moving at will is not a final victory. Barack Obama being elected to the presidency is not a final victory. There are no final victories.
And Dr. Edwards, we're going to definitely have to have you on back. I just want to end with something I wrote in the article, again, influenced by you a lot. It says, "In my lifetime, we saw the brilliant imagery of U.S. sprinters Tommy Smith and John Carlos raising their clenched fists with a black glove on the winner's stand in the Mexico City Olympics. which, parenthesis, you played a major role in organizing for those young organizers out there. It did not happen spontaneously, and Tommy Smith and John Colas were full participants in their own history. But who can begin to understand that in order for this tactic to work, they first had to win gold and bronze medals.
Absolutely.
As two of the greatest athletes in the world. And then, in Mexico City, where Mexican students had been murdered, they risked their amateur and professional careers in front of 100,000... In front of 100,000 people in the amphitheater and millions of people all over the world. They were part of a much larger narrative in a period of worldwide and third world revolution. I can't thank you enough. I want to come back and have you on the show pretty soon, so we'll continue the conversation. Thank you for the terrific work you do. And you get the last sentence.
Continue to struggle.
We got a deal. Take good care, Dr. Edwards.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, everybody, if you wonder why we work so hard on Voices from the Frontlines, it's to have conversations like that and to have just one amazing person after another on Voices. We're very appreciative of our producer, Crystal McMillan, who's able to get the guests. We're very appreciative of people that just want to be on the show.